Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the head of public engagement at the museum. This podcast explores the relationship between people and objects within the collection of the museum. And today my guest is my colleague, Christopher Jones. Chris is the collection manager for documentation, and his responsibilities at the museum include maintaining our collection database and overseeing various digitization projects. Chris, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here, Craig.
Now, could you begin by telling us a little bit about how long you've been with the Chow Chak Wing Museum team and then what your role at the museum actually curtails?
Sure. Actually, this January, I will have been with the organization for 9 years, which is amazing, actually. It's amazing how it sort of creeps up on you. And so my role is working in collection management, which is a part of the museum that looks after the physical and informational needs of the collection. So, as you were sort of saying in your introduction, a large part of what I do is looking after the collection database and other sort of projects that relate to data that can be taking photographs of collection or doing data entry projects, making sure we sort of adhere to certain sort of standards. So looking after that kind of thing. But we're a reasonably small team, so we all sort of muck in together and I'll often be moving objects around or doing anything that's sort of required. So we sort of all hands on deck depending on what kind of work we're doing.
I find it interesting that I suspect you've seen more of the collection than anyone else, certainly more than I have, and probably more than the curators outside of their own area as well, just because of this direct connection with collection of information about the material that we have.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the great joys, I think, of the area we work, which what attracts me to it is that because I'm not a subject specialist and I'm working across all collections, I get a little bit of knowledge about everything that we're doing. One of the great things we did was working on doing the digitization project where we're going through and photographing large proportions of the collection in preparation for the move to the new museum. Basically saw more objects than I think anybody would see because the curators tend to work in their area. They might work at other areas potentially, but generally have their sort of areas of interest and expertise. Whereas I, because I'm required to work across all collections, get this very privileged position, which I think is in some ways actually where I see a lot of things like the painting I'm talking about today, was something that came out of working in the digitization project, and it came across my desk as something that I'm working on in that way. And so one of the great joys.
I must say that I often will see you off on a research hunt to gather more data as well too, which is always fascinating to watch you.
Yeah. But
really a unique position in many ways within the context of a museum.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the areas that I sort of take responsibility are around sort of provenance and sort of research in order to understand how objects entered into the collection, which is always fascinating. And one of the things that always frustrates me is if I see sort of initials rather than a full name, and I want to get information about that full name for legal reasons, because it's important for us to know how objects entered the collection, because that's our claim to ownership. But also, at the same time, so many stories come out of those acquisition pathlines, and that's what fascinates me. And once you start going down there, it's dangerous. You can end up in all sorts of different directions
and
going, I really need to pull back, and there's actually work to be done. So it's about getting that balance right.
Yes.
But certainly, I think doing that kind of research into that is fascinating, which is, I think, not to jump ahead, it's certainly like an example of the object that I'm talking about today.
Yeah, we'll get to the painting in just a moment. Before we do, could you talk our listeners through your previous experience in the museum sector prior to coming and joining the team at the University of Sydney?
Sure. So I think of myself as an information management person. So I come from an archives and libraries as well as museum background. So before I came to Sydney, I'd been working in archives in Auckland. Before that, I'd been working at the NGV in Melbourne. I worked at Auckland Museum in New Zealand for many, many years. And I've worked in libraries as well, particularly over in the UK when I was over there for a couple of years. So I've always been interested in working in information environments, of which, that whole sector I just find intriguing to me. And I think, again, it's that joy that I find of working across specialist areas and gaining little bits of knowledge and just getting a little excited about all sorts of different kinds of areas of human activity.
Well, we've spoken on this podcast in the past with some of the curators about the concept of the object biography and how it's not just an object or an artwork in its own right, but often comes with associated paperwork and ephemera as well, too. In a sense, you're the keeper of some of that knowledge.
And I think it's all about making sure that that's all captured in one place so it's then available for researchers or for curatorial staff to then start to pull together those stories and make connections and start to sort of think about that biography of the object, which I love, that idea. So it's really interesting. And so that is a key part of our responsibility. And in a way, we have a collection database in some ways. It's about having that central place of truth, is often how it's described, as sort of a point of focus for other things to happen.
Very quickly, what's the system that we do use at the Chow Chak Wing Museum?
So we use a system called EMU, which is made by a company called Axial. Originally, it was an Australian database. It has since become part of a European company that sort of has a number of other different collection databases. So it's a system which is used widely throughout Australia because of its Australian origins, but it's also used through North America and the UK as well, and also New Zealand at Te Papa, curiously. So it's a great system, and it's very sort of powerful, allows us to do all sorts of amazing things, including sharing information online. So we use data that we capture in our EMU database, which stands for Electronic Museum, and share that through our collection search online, so people can look at our collection before they come to the museum, or after, or instead of, potentially.
Or while listening to the podcast. And we invite our listeners to actually look at the work that you've chosen today. You've already alluded to the fact that it's a painting, but can you take us through what item from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection you've chosen today to be the object,
the
quote
object,
unquote?
The object I decided to go with, just tricky to sort of choose a favorite, because there are so many wonderful stories that go along with things that I've sort of come across in the collection. But it's a painting called Cello by an artist called Walter Bowring from around sort of 1927 or so.
Now, we have an image of that painting in front of us, but could you talk our listeners through what the painting conveys? What's the image actually of?
Yeah, so it's a portrait of a cellist. The scene is basically a cellist is sitting on a chair and playing the cello, looking towards a score, you would think. And so he's in this darkened room, sitting with a cello, and he's looking towards what looks like a painting easel. And on that painting easel is actually an abstract watercolor painting, which is just where my intrigue sort of starts. Mm. In the room, there are other sort of paintings, so it looks like it's an artist's studio, maybe. So, it's basically a portrait of the cellist, but in a sort of a intriguing studio environment.
His gaze is very focused, isn't it?
It is, and he's in sort of mid-stroke. He's sort of obviously working through some notes, and you can see his hand sort of working the fretboard, and it's very much caught in the action of playing the cello.
So I guess the obvious question is, why have you chosen this particular painting?
Well, I think you can kind of tell by what I was sort of saying in my description of it. When I first looked at it, I thought, oh, that's lovely. It's a portrait of a cellist, and it's like I'm a fan of music, and so I was like drawn to it for that reason. But the closer I looked at it, it was like, what is he playing? What is the score? What does this painting mean? And I just that being drawn into it, and it basically has me asking questions. And as soon as I have questions, I'm then
intrigued.
I'm intrigued, and it sort of just pulls me in, and it just seems incongruous, and there must be something going on here that I don't necessarily get initially, and I need to look a little bit further into.
So as you started to look a bit further, as you dug into the rabbit warren, when was this when you actually, because I mean you have actually written a short piece in our magazine Muse in the past. When was this? In 2016?
I think it was a couple of years ago,
yeah.
Maybe.
So you obviously took that initial curiosity and did some research on it. What can you tell us about the artist, about Walter Arminger Bowring and his career?
Yeah, so he was born in 1874, and he's a New Zealander, which immediately draws me to him, of course, as I'm a fellow New Zealander. And he was born in Auckland, which is where I lived most of my life when I was in New Zealand, and actually studied at Auckland Boys Grammar, which is actually my old secondary school. So there's sort of these like amazing sort of connections. In 1874, I was born in 1972, so there's 100 years prior. So there's this really interesting thing around him as an artist, connected to me very personally, which I quite like. And so he was in New Zealand painting there, had a very successful career as a portrait painter, but also did a number of cartoons for newspapers as well.
Oh, right.
So, which, it's an interesting sort of combination to be like a fine artist, but also to have this other, probably a revenue stream, I'm assuming.
Yes.
But maybe sort of an expression of his political interests as well.
Yeah.
And he's quite well thought of in the Hawke's Bay. They have a large collection of his paintings there. And I, during my research, came across articles that they've written there about him. And so he's well thought of. I think he did a lot of paintings around World War One and sort of doing portraits associated with that. So there's a strong New Zealand story that I don't know so much about, curiously, as a New Zealander. And he moved to Sydney in 1925.
Oh, okay. Did he spend any time in Europe? I mean, so many Antipodean artists went to Europe to make their reputation.
And he went over there to study, I think, as much as anything else. So there was certainly a sort of a journey from going over to Europe to see the art over there, to study. But he was only there for a couple of years.
Right.
Like, he wouldn't sort of establish himself there for whatever reason. And I guess that's always these questions that come up, is what didn't happen for him there? Because you'd think you'd go over there and you'd establish a career.
Yeah.
But maybe that wasn't his purpose.
Yeah.
So he did have his time doing as all the Antipodeans do. As I said myself, like, we all go and spend a couple of years over in the motherland and then come back. And so he moved to Sydney 1925 with his second wife, Violet, who was also an artist.
Right.
And very much became a part of the Sydney art scene. When you look in the newspapers, which so much of my research is using Trove, which is an amazing resource for answering questions or to provide more questions, you see his name often coming up in sort of various sort of social circles in the art scene in the 1920s. I mean, he died in 1931, so he was only in Sydney for a very short period of time, but managed to make quite an impression in that time.
In regards to this particular painting, what year was it painted in?
So this is not actually dated, but the research suggests that this is sort of circa 1927.
So he's been in Sydney for a short period
of time.
Now, it's interesting, I guess, back to your initial curiosity about the image that the musician is looking at, because this is really fitting into a much larger debate that was taking place in the 1920s decade, wasn't it, about the connectivity between music and visual arts.
It was. It's so interesting. And this is where my sort of research started to lead, is into, it's kind of a combination of stories of personality in the society that was happening and who knew who and what was sort of happening around sort of the art scene at that time. Boehring is very much a traditional painter. He paints in the realist style. You can see this in this particular example, even though there may be an abstract painting featured very obliquely in the portrait, it is a realistic painting. That is what he's known for. In fact, I even came across a quote from him saying that he actually didn't really like modern paintings, these experiments.
Yeah.
And so,
did he experiment at all, though, with cubism and abstraction?
No, not at all. No, so, he was straight through a realist painter, and I think he was, sort of maybe, it's interesting to be alive in Sydney at that time and dismiss that kind of painting and to not engage that, because it's so much of the conversation that was happening around him at that time was about that, which is making me sort of think that's what this painting may be about, possibly. And so it's interesting, he was associated with the Joseph Kretschmann Club, which is where we actually got the painting from. So there's a couple of paintings that came to us from the Joseph Kretschmann Club in the 1960s and 68, which is when that club wound up. And it was a club that was set up in the 1920s, around 1923, as a sort of like a music appreciation club, but attracted artists and other people. And it was named for Joseph Kretschmann, who was like a bohemian who came to Australia in 1876 and died in 1918. And so he made such an impression on the city that his supporters, his followers, who maybe had seen him conduct or had maybe been taught by him as he was a music teacher, they set up the society for art appreciation, mostly music, but it ended up moving into other areas. And so they, when you look in the newspapers, you see that there will be lectures going on there and talking about various art subjects.
So it's a learned society to some degree.
Very much so, yeah. And so, interestingly, in one of the references I found on the 26th of August, 1927, Antonio Dottilo Rubo gave a talk to the club titled The Relationship of Music to Painting. And as soon as I found that reference, I think, well, this is fascinating. Mm. This is like 1927. This is around the time when the painting was produced. I don't know much about this particular artist. Curiously, the other painting that came to us from the Joseph Kretschmann Club in 1968 was a portrait of Antonio Dottilo Rubo.
Ah,
so there's really strong connections there. So there's something going on.
Yeah.
So I looked into Dottilo Rubo, and he was an artist and a teacher. And one of his students was Roy de Maistre, who, along with Roland Wakeland, another artist who we have in the collection, was really interested in that relationship between art and music. And they developed a whole theory together around color harmonization and identified analogies sort of between colors and notes of the musical scale. So they were very interested in this. And so in 1919, so a little bit before what period we're talking about, they had an exhibition called Color in Art. And people in the newspaper talked about it as being pictures you could whistle. which is such a sort of a fascinating sort of idea. And it was like quite groundbreaking. It was the first exhibition of abstract art in Australia, so in 1919. So, you know, reasonably early, but not compared to, say, maybe Europe, where those movements were happening.
Yeah.
But Totila Rubo, his maestro's teacher, was very supportive of this, publicly sort of said, this is really interesting stuff. We need to support this kind of thing. So there's a sort of interesting tension here. And I think the fact that there's a talk at the club about this relationship of music to painting, that the Bowring is in association with this club at that time, part of that sort of Sydney Society of Artists and that sort of sharing of ideas.
Yes.
And there's a sort of debate. And so when I see this, it makes me think, okay, there's something going on here. Is it a commentary? Is it a gentle mocking in some ways? And it's one of the interesting things in the background of the painting, in the sort of the shadowy rear of the studio, you see another painting which is, it's hard to say, it looks like a clown maybe.
It does, doesn't it?
Maybe sort of like a harlequin or something holding a guitar. And so I think there's something there in terms of that, again, art and like sort of painting and music being represented in a sort of more traditional way of a portrait of a performer.
Yes.
But the kind of character they are they a clown? Is it mocking? Is it, I don't know, there's something intriguing which says more. And so I think given the timing, given the context, I think there's something that the artist is saying. He stated he doesn't like modernist art movements, but here he is saying, I'm showing you what a nonsense this would be. Here is a, you know, what do you mean? Like they're going to start using a score as a sort of like...
A work of art as a score.
Yeah. I mean, curiously, as you go through sort of the history of art, this is exactly the kind of thing that composers start to use as scores. I'm thinking here of John Cage using, you know, sort of the grain of wood as a sort of like a marking point for different kinds of musical scores. Or musical scores get much more abstract and move away from those traditional notations into different kinds of things. So he may be mocking in this painting, but I think what he's almost doing is saying, actually, this is where we're headed.
Yeah.
It isn't necessarily what De Maistre and Wakelin were doing in terms of their ideas. They were drawing much more about colour theory and harmony and making those connections rather than that coming together of visual art and sort of music and those things coming together. But I think there's a sort of a continuity there.
That's really quite extraordinary, isn't it? So potentially he's mocking of the time, yet also reflective of the time.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's what makes me sort of intrigued by this painting. It is a sort of thing of a snapshot of when there was real debate around whether or not this was actually legitimate conversations for art.
Yeah.
I think history's kind of shown maybe where we've gone with that. I think people are much more excited about sort of, you know, these artists who did do that exploration.
Yes.
Because so much art is about breaking rules or finding new ways of expressing ideas.
And certainly the rest of the 20th century was to prove that there was a symbiotic relationship between art and music when you know, even if just in the album cover, even if nothing else, but certainly a lot of artists that were listening to music, you know, I forget Brett Whiteley in particular, but a lot of artists who were listening to music while they were creating as well, that you know, it may not necessarily have been what was being conceived and considered in the early 20s, but you are right that there was always going to be that relationship.
Yeah.
Is this the only Bowring painting we have?
No, actually, we have quite a few in the collection, which is so intriguing to me, not just from different sources as well.
Oh, right. Okay.
Again, he's a portrait painter. We have a strong collection of portraits in the collection. And even for the short period of time that he was in Sydney, he entered like a large number of paintings into the Archibald.
Ah, okay.
Which is often the case. And in fact, our collection has many, many paintings. I think something like 65, 70 paintings in the collection that were entered in the Archibald Prize. And so he is an example of one of those artists in the collection. And three of the paintings that we have of the six paintings in the collection were entered in the Archibald.
Ah, okay.
But they're all portraits. Some of them are of academics from the university. Others, figures from the artistic community. There's a portrait of a conductor. Again, that connection to music.
Yeah.
But they're all straightforward portraits. Nothing as intriguing as the one we're talking about today. This one's a little bit of an outlier.
Because we have no idea who the celloist is, do we?
We don't. But of course, being myself, I can't help but be intrigued by this. So I can't find any record, but the dream would be, of course, that you find reference to Bowring painting a particular, you know, but I don't think that actually happened. And I suspect what it is actually just somebody that was around at that time. And so following on from that, there's actually some research that I did into it was that there was a Dutch cellist who came to Sydney around 1926, so the timing is right, was associated with the Joseph Kretschmann Club.
Right.
I found a photograph of him in a newspaper that doesn't look dissimilar. He doesn't have any facial hair, and this portrait of the man doesn't have any facial hair. But then
this is a very anonymous middle-aged man.
Yeah, so it could be him. His name was Jules van der Clay. I would love to think that that was him, but... Yeah. You know, you have to be conservative in these matters, you can kind of entertain the idea that this is who it might be, but, you know, the only way to find out would be to find other photographs of him in the future and then confirm. I mean, he's a reasonably distinctive-looking man.
Mm. Very distinguished.
Does look very distinguished. Yep, so, yeah, it could be him, but I guess those are sort of further questions for further research.
I suspect you've already answered this particular question right throughout the thread of our discussion today, but what meaning does the painting have for you personally?
I think you're right. I think it for me, it's about how an object can be sort of a focus for story gathering. It's about understanding a particular point in time. What are people doing around that period, and why does this thing exist? And I think those stories are echoed through the collections, and it's just endless stories. You pick up a necklace and suddenly you look at where it came from and you're suddenly finding stories about how this object came to be in this country and who that person was. And it's just those sort of stories intrigue me, and this was another example of the deep dive into understanding the context and what's going on.
One of the things that I'm personally interested in terms of this relationship between us as an individual and a particular individual work of art or artifact or object is the changing nature of our relationship. Do you find the way that you look at the painting now that you've done some research has changed the way that you considered the work, or the way you looked at the work in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I see more details the more I look at it. Now that I know more about it, I see more. I think it's about, and then I feel frustration because I have more questions. Whereas before I didn't have those questions, I have these new questions which I sort of niggle at me. I go, ooh, what's the answer? I think it's endlessly fascinating.
Fantastic. Now, look, the question I'm asking everyone who appears on the podcast is this. In one word, what does this particular object signify for you?
It's interesting. It's a word that's been coming up quite a bit in the work I've been doing this year, and I think it's curiosity. It's about being drawn into something, and it stimulates a certain kind of enthusiasm and a curiosity for things, to ask questions, to want to know. Mm. I think that's key about all of the collections.
It is, isn't it?
And that's what starts that journey towards improving your knowledge, is like that curiosity, that openness to things you don't know about.
Yeah. And indeed the curiosity of the artist himself too in terms of...
Well, that's the thing. I'm intrigued because what I've read is it feels like his statements make him sound very closed and not interested in modern developments in art. And yet here he is taking the time to make quite a beautiful, it's not an insubstantial painting. It's a reasonable size. It's sort of like a meter by 70 centimeters. It's like it's a significant painting looking at a different area. So maybe he was making statements in the media in one way, but maybe feeling another way or something. Yes. What was his motivation?
He might have been challenged by a particularly good debate or talk at the club.
Maybe there was, I don't know. I'd love to know the content of the talk that was at the club in 1927 to see how much it went into this and what the actual content was, which is, I'd love to see if maybe the State Library has records, those sort of things.
Yes,
it's always fascinating to sort of get a sense.
Back into the rabbit warren.
Yes. Never ending.
Now, the painting itself is not currently on public display in the Chow Chak Wing Museum, but obviously we can access it via the collection search on our website, but if it was to be exhibited in the future, what would you like our listeners to think about when they stop to look at this particular work by Bowring?
I think to remember that the paintings happen in a context and that they are of a time, and so they're part of a conversation. And so much of art and the art that we tend to value retrospectively are works which carried on that conversation, making connections. I'd love to see this exhibited with some works by maybe De Maistre and other works sort of looking at that sort of that relationship of colour and music and kind of butting them up against each other and see what happens in that conversation, and to see that. But I think remember where something came from, that it comes from a, a human impulse at a particular point in time in reaction to the things that are going on around them.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Chris. Christopher Jones, very much appreciate you joining us today, sharing your knowledge, sharing some of the stories from your own research. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. It was really fun.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chowchak Wing Museum acknowledges the traditional owners, and we pay our respect to elders, past, present, and emerging. Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chowchak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.